This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Good to have you with us. I hope you're doing well. You are listening to Red Ice Radio, and I'm Henrik. We are coming to you from Conformist Sweden. Thank you for your interest in learning about ideas that are essential to grasping the problems of our age. G. Edward Griffin is a writer and documentary film producer with many successful titles to his credit. He is well known because of his talent for researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that all can understand. He has dealt with such diverse subjects as archaeology and ancient Earth history, the Federal Reserve System and international banking, terrorism, internal subversion, the history of taxation, U.S. foreign policy, the science and politics of cancer therapy, the Supreme Court, and the United Nations. Mr. Griffin is a graduate of the University of Michigan, where he majored in speech and communications. He is also the creator of the Reality Zone Audio Archives and is president of American Media, a publishing and video production company. In this program, we are going to cover the collectivist conspiracy, including the ideology and nature of a collectivist and why it is so dangerous. We'll hear about Cecil Rhodes and the secret society most have no clue about. But first, Mr. Griffin explains how the anger of the Occupy movement was misdirected. We also address the subject of capitalism. G. Edward explains how collectivism replaced capitalism in America a long time ago, and we'll cover the model of collectivism and how it manifests. Mr. Griffin warns of full-term collectivism. That's 100% government and 0% freedom that will end in totalitarianism. All right, welcome back, Mr. Griffin. It was a few years ago since we last talked, and it's good to have you back once again with us. So thank you for coming on the program, first of all.
Well, thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Now, many interesting things have, of course, happened during the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I'd like to begin to get your take on what you see has happened, both in the United States, but also around the world when it comes to the economy, the bankers, the left-right paradigm, and how that further has polarized people, and how you see this as an advancement, I guess, of what we can call the collectivist conspiracy. This has continued to unfold, and this is some of the main things I'd like to get to here today. But first of all, do you have any comments on the election in the United States? Did you really have a good choice this time, or was it again the lesser of two evils? How do you see it from your point of view?
Well, I guess it wasn't really the lesser of two evils. It was the greater of two evils. That's my take on it. You and your listeners are quite aware of our views here. I think that the Republican and the Democrat Party are merely two wings of the same party. They play that right versus left game pretty well. I guess that happens in all countries nowadays, but it's certainly the technique has been refined here in the U.S. The candidates and the leadership of both parties are in basic agreement on just about everything of importance. When you find any disagreement, it's little fine-tuning of this and fine-tuning of that. But the major issues, foreign policy issues, for example, are a big thing with the U.S. I look at the scene here as a question of survival now. It used to be that the United States could take a lot of hits and it wouldn't make a lot of difference because it was big and powerful, but it's been whittled away primarily by its own leaders to weaken it, and it's almost at the point of collapse now economically and socially, and there's a lot of division and a lot of confusion. And so I look at this primarily as how much longer can we survive as a nation. And in that framework, there are two basic major issues, I would say, that should be the topic of political debate. And the one is, will the United States, and for that matter other countries too, will they survive as sovereign nations, or will they be finally swallowed up in this thing they like to call the New World Order, the global government based on the model of collectivism? And that's one issue. And the other issue is, will the United States and, again, other countries also? Will they maintain an economic base that is solid? Will their money be worth anything? Are they going down the tubes economically? Those are the two major issues, in my view, that will determine whether or not any nation will survive much longer. And yet, neither of those topics will be addressed by the candidates of the major political parties here.
Yeah.
They will not touch those topics because they know they're taboo. And so the both parties are in total agreement that the United States and other nations should gradually be absorbed into a new world order, a world governance based on the model of collectivism. And neither party has any idea or any plan to reverse the continuing economic crisis. So there you have it. What's the point of having two parties if they're in total agreement on the major issues? In fact, won't even discuss the major issues because they know that the public really doesn't like their position, so they just avoid it.
Indeed, it has become incredibly polarized as well, and people now take sides in this political debacle, as it's a football game or something like that, and people are equally, I think, dedicated.
They like to have people polarized on minor issues, but they don't want them talking about the major issues at all.
And do you see that that's the... was that the setup from the get-go, or do you think that it slowly has evolved this way because it's been have been beneficial to the political class?
Well, the get-go, I don't know what that means, how far back we want to go, but if we go back all the way to the origin of the political parties, I don't think it was that way then at all. It was just a natural formation, a grouping of people who had similar goals, similar ideas. But once the political parties became established as organizations, once they became corporations, once they had power, once they had funding and a great deal of money at their disposal, what happened to them is what happens to most corporations, most organizations, and that is that they take on a life force of their own, and then they're dominated by certain very powerful people who... don't play very fair. I mean, politics is dirty, they say. Well, politics is dirty in corporations, too. You see a lot of politics in corporations as little groups struggle with each other for dominance. And when one administration is finally removed and the one guy is kicked out, he takes with him all of his team. The new team comes in and they kick out everybody who's on the old team and so forth. It's cutthroat. And so I think that was sort of an evolution that took place over perhaps 100 years or more, but it certainly is in place now.
Indeed. Now, in the time of the Occupy movement and Anonymous and everything else that has unfolded, it's been quite chaotic. Everyone is looking for a scapegoat, if you will, as well. And this is different depending on who you ask, where they are in the political spectrum. It's either the capitalist or the corporations. To some, it might be the government. To others, it might be someone else. But where do you stand on that note? And do you see that there is more of a joining factor here than these different, seemingly at least, different groups of people?
Well, it's interesting to see that in the last few years, especially, well, since 2008, when the economy began to really melt down here in the States. Interesting to see that more and more people are looking at the banking and financial industry for the bad guys. Prior to that, that was an area that no one really examined closely. Banks were considered to be sacrosanct. Banks were considered to be wonderful institutions. Banks were considered to be institutions of great restraint. It was considered to be the kind of a place where a lot of caution was taking place and honesty was revered and all that sort of thing, which was not true. But that was the image that had been projected, and the public had bought that image years ago, and no one ever was able to challenge it successfully in the public scene anyway. But then when things started to unwind and the public got a whiff of some of the rotten smells that were coming out of the financial industry, and then as a result of people like well, like myself, and my book was getting out there about the Federal Reserve. By that time, there were many, many thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, actually, that had pretty much a good foundation for exposing what was really going on. And then when Ron Paul hit the Republican nomination track and started talking about the Federal Reserve, well, all of a sudden, it was like the dam broke. And the public was hungry for more information, and I think they sensed that this was true, that the financial institutions were ripping them off, and they were doing it legally, and they had, you know, unfair advantage because of their political influence, and they were able to buy politicians and so forth. And all of a sudden, this dam broke, and the people were out there saying, let's take a look at these banks. And there was a lot of momentum developed very quickly to audit the Fed and possibly abolish the Fed. And as you mentioned a moment ago, the Occupy movement came into being very quickly, and these demonstrators were camping out in front of the banks and the Treasury Department and so forth. So the financial industry became sort of a target for a lot of the public anger and resentment that had built up over all of this time. And that was, I thought, very interesting and very positive sign, except for the fact that it was misdirected, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean that, take the Occupy movement, for example, which seems to be somewhat disorganized, but actually I think it's pretty well funded and directed behind the scenes by some organizations and possibly some nations that would like to push America even further to the left, if I might use that phrase for the moment, even though it means to the right as well. What I mean is push it further to collectivism. The leadership of that movement and a lot of the organizations that were dominant in the coalition to put it together were the same ones that always, over the years, came together and supported other themes like disarmament and primarily, let's get right to the point, a lot of the direction and funding came from Moscow. And so that was, we know what that's all about. Anybody that's, you know, been following this for the years, they're not really interested in reform. They're just interested in mobilizing people under the banner of reform so that they can build a revolutionary force to topple the existing government.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. And but anyway, even putting that aside for the moment, a lot of these demonstrators were properly angry with the financial industry, but what they were demanding was that the government play a larger role in it. What they didn't realize is the fact that the government and the financial industry were already a partnership. They were already a single entity, and that the asking the government to play a larger role in it was exactly what that group wanted.
Yes.
The destruction of free enterprise, the introduction of a collectivist state where you know, the government apparently has complete control over the financial industry, but in reality it's the financial industry that has complete control over the government. But to the outside you can't tell. You know, the surface still looks like there's a division between government and banks, but underneath it, it's the blood supply goes in both directions. There's a single heart and a single brain. And so the demonstrators were calling for more of the same that was causing their misery. And that's where it was very unsettling to me.
Well, exactly. I think it's a really important point. I mean, to explain that they are in bed together. And from the outside, if you don't look deep enough, you might look like it is, you know, free enterprise that is to blame, or free market capitalism. But there is a nuance here. There's something called crony capitalism, or the fact that it's a kind of a monopoly where, as you say, it doesn't really matter who's in charge at the moment, because the corporations are, you know, in with the government, and the government people are those who previously have been on the boards on the company. So they make decisions that are ultimately beneficial to themselves. And I think if we don't make this distinction and analysis, it can be very dangerous. What do you see is the, let's say, the problem then, if we look at free market capitalism as being the villain in this? Let's say it's like that's the case, and we go after that.
Well,
how is that dangerous?
Right, right on target, because I resent that phrase, crony capitalism. It's crony, all right, but it's crony socialism. The fact of the matter is that capitalism hasn't existed, at least around here, it hasn't existed for decades. Capitalism was whittled away, and it was practically invisible at the First World War. And by the time the Second World War came along, there was so much government regulation and intervention in the markets that capitalism was free market capitalism, which is really what capitalism is all about. If you take the free market element out of capitalism, you don't have capitalism anymore. And that's where people fail to recognize it. So they're calling this thing capitalism because that's the way it used to be. But in fact, it's not. Capitalism has been gone. So what we're seeing today is socialism or collectivism. Collectivism is the better word, but it's collectivism. And but yet the demonstrators are out there saying, these dirty capitalists, they did this, and these bad capitalists did that. Let's get rid of capitalism. Well, yeah. What they're really saying is, let's push the country further away from capitalism and deeper into collectivism, where it has been for a long time. So we're back to the theme that I said a moment ago. These people are really calling for more of the same, of what has created the misery, and this is not reform at all that they're talking about.
Would you go as far as to say that a majority of the people we're talking about here, not those who are complaining on this, but those who are behind the system that we're talking about, could we call them Fabian socialists? Is there a particular classification here we could get into as well? What do you think?
Well, we could fine-tune it, I suppose. Some of them, I believe, would properly be defined as Fabian socialists. I think a lot of them would better be defined as Rhodesians, because they're part of that organization that Cecil Rhodes created, you know, back at the turn of the last century, and it's worldwide. It's very dominant in the Western nations. Most people don't know anything about that. It doesn't get into the news, but it's perhaps the most powerful of all of the combines out there, in at least in the Western world. It's created by Cecil Rhodes. It's a secret society. When he died, he left his great fortune to the funding of that secret society. That we've all heard about the Rhodes scholarships, but what people don't realize is that that's the recruitment funnel for this organization. And they created roundtables, and what they call them roundtables, in all of the British former British dependencies. I was in Canada 2 days ago. I'm making a presentation, and I had to advise some of the people in Canada that they have an organization there, called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and that's part of this Rhodesian group. Canada has one, you know, New Zealand has one, Australia has one. All of the former British dependencies have an organization that's called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which is a little front group for the round table behind it. And they set one up in the United States, too, but they didn't call it the Royal Institute of International Affairs, because Americans don't go for the word royal too well. That's for all those Britishers, you know. So in this country, they call it the Council on Foreign Relations. And when you look at these groups at all of these respective countries, that's the power center of the nation. That is the what you might honestly call the hidden government of these countries. So the point of all is that there are groupings and subgroupings that you could look at and identify certain organizations by name, such as Fabian Socialists, Rhodesians. In this country, we've got Skull and Bones, and then, of course, there are the Bilderberger Group and the Trilateralists and so forth. But it gets awfully confusing when you're trying to unwind all of that. I think for analysis purposes, it's probably better just to look at all of these people as collectivists. They all have a common ideology of collectivism. And that is, of course, that the state should be all-powerful, that the people should obey the state, and they should serve the state for the greater good of the greater number. That's the common ideology to all of these philosophies, all of these ideologies. And it's just the opposite of how we started here in the States. It was the other way around, that the people created the government. The government was to serve the people and protect the people. But over the years, that has been turned around, and now it's the people serving the government.
How do you think that this political polarization that we're seeing right now is actually preventing people from seeing this agenda that you're talking about with a clear vision? I mean, I think for those who don't look at conspiracy, for instance, they lose out on the big picture and actually become a pawn in this game, if you will. But many people I've noticed actually turn off as soon as you talk about some of these things, they might have heard. Well, let me take another example. Recently, I've heard Glenn Beck to talk about the very real Agenda 21, for example. And people think that he's some kind of lunatic conspiracy theorist or something else. I don't know how they classify him. But therefore, whatever he talks about, as long as you run in the opposite direction, 180 degrees, you're going to be in the safe zone, if you know what I mean, Ed. And how do you think, could that ever be broken down, or do people have to willingly on their own kind of take themselves out of this left-right phony paradigm to be able to see through this game?
That's a good question, isn't it? The answer to that question will determine the future, whether or not freedom survives. Because if the people don't pick themselves up, so to speak, it's not going to happen. Because right now the major channels of communication and leadership are pretty well dominated by collectivists, the kind of people who want to keep the masses in this sort of a stupor. Because I think it's necessary to point out that not all collectivists think of themselves as evil people. In fact, probably very few of them do. They think of themselves as doing what is right for mankind. They honestly believe that someone has to rule, someone has to make these hard decisions, and the people are too damn dumb, they think, to make decisions on their own. And, you know, and to a certain degree, there's some truth in that. But nevertheless, the other point of view is that therefore, people like us, we collectivists, have to make these decisions. And sometimes we have to fool the common man so that he will make the right decision. Sometimes we have to lie to him so that he will make the right decisions. Sometimes we even have to get rid of some large groups of people. We may have to see that couple of thousand people get killed here and there in order to create the kind of emotional hysteria that we need them to have to support a certain foreign policy, to go to war, for example. And so they really are quite cold and analytical about it. And even if it involves the deliberate killing of thousands of people, of their own countrymen, they look at it as necessary for the greater good of the greater number and betterment of society and better for the group in the long run. So they kind of look at themselves as heroes throughout all of this. Mm-hmm. And it's as long as these types of people are in control of the media and the educational system and so forth, you cannot ever hope that the average person is going to get the truth. He's going to continue to be propagandized. He's going to continue to be molded. His opinion is going to be engineered. And that's what you're witnessing, is that people turn off when they hear the truth because their opinion has been engineered by all of this media and educational system to look at that as some kind of a kooky, very bad point of view. Well, how do you overcome that? How did I overcome it? I guess, and the others I know of that I talk to from day to day, each of us have had to overcome that ourselves and just piece together the information where we find it and stop and challenge the mainstream. Not a lot of people can do that or are willing to do that, because it's a very uncomfortable position to be in, because you're always running upstream and you're getting a lot of flack from people that look at you as though you're crazy. And it's not a comfortable feeling to stand up against the crowd and say, no, this is wrong. I don't care how many people are taking this position. It's still wrong, and here's why I think so. Not a lot of people want to do that. So now we come to the next level. Those of us who can see the truth, it's up to us now to take on our responsibility and start to offer leadership, if we can, to allow others who are not willing to be the tip of the arrow, so to speak, but at least they'd be willing to be the shank of the arrow. So some of us have to take the big blows, but after you, let me put it this way, after a person out there has heard the truth, the harsh truth, the first time, he reacts against it. Oh, that can't be true. After he hears it the second time, he's probably going to say, oh, there's another kook. When he hears it the third time, he's going to say, where are these people getting this information? After he hears it the fourth time, he's going to say, oh, yeah, that sounds familiar. After he hears it the fifth time, he'll say, oh, sure, I always knew that. So the point I'm trying to make is that we have a responsibility to provide leadership, in a sense, to allow many of those people who are not willing to be tips of the arrows to feel more comfort and more support in the point of view which reflects the truth.
Well, I always heard this saying that it's only dead fish that flows, down with the stream. The rest kind of tries to jump up, go at it, as it were. This is after all about the individual and not being in the comfort zone of the collective. I mean, that's after all where the majority stands today. Go along to get along, and I think you're right as well, Ed, when you point out that these collectivists, definitely they justify their own behavior, that this ultimately is for the betterment of all. Therefore, whatever we do is for the greater good. And how far do you think they might go in this agenda? I mean, if they would maintain power, let's say, without anyone trying to resist this, we have things like the Georgia Guidestones, for instance, that talk about culling of the herd, as it were. Do you think they would go that far?
They're already doing that, in my view. Sure, they would go that far. There's another element to this. I think so many of these collectivists start off as true idealists. They really believe all of this. I know when I went to school, I was taught collectivism, not by that name, but all the principles I was taught, the greater good for the greater number. That sounded like a good idea. A lot of people start off as idealists, and they really believe their own propaganda. But when they begin to climb the ladder of power within these control organizations, and they come to reality, I think most of them lose their idealism. And the main goal from a certain point in their lives forward, the main goal becomes how to stay in power and how to increase the power and how to use these idealistic slogans as tools for gaining power and holding it. But I don't think they really believe it anymore. It just becomes a power struggle. So what you see is that eventually only those who go to the top, only the most ruthless ones do it and are the successful. So by the time you're looking at the very top leadership, you're looking at a pretty ruthless group, because all of the truly idealistic ones have been weeded out by that time.
What would you say, Ed, to someone who at this point then thinking, wait a minute. I mean, I think that it's all the individualists out there that are dangerous. Egotism is to blame for the world's problem, especially those who only have their own best interest at heart. And those are at the core of the banking system, of capitalism, of politics. And if we only can get out those people out of the way, things will be good. What would you say to a person like that?
Well, that sounds pretty good, except nowhere in history is it supported, because every time there has been a social experiment that fulfills that strategy, you find that things do not get better. If anything, they get worse. The usual, that's the slogan, by the way, of what we used to call communism, that the whole
sure.
Bolshevik Revolution was, comrades, let us have a revolution. Let us eliminate the capitalist exploiters, Let's come to power. The proletariat must come to power. We'll have dictatorship of proletariat and all that. People will now rule. Get rid of those greedy capitalists. That was the enemy. And so in many countries, communism did come to power on that theory. So what happened? Well, did the people live better? No. They were just exploited by a new group, a new oligarchy, calling themselves communists. Nothing really changed. It was just a trick. It was a slogan. And it was still an oligarchy of ruling class. And actually, the exploitation was worse in most cases. So it's just it's a trick. And it always works on, well, not always, but it tends to work more on idealistic young people. It worked on me when I was young. And because I wanted to believe that, but I think when you get older and you've seen what actually happens in the world, you realize that this is all just baloney. It's propaganda, And what's really going on is that you've got two groups of people, and sometimes more, vying with each other for power. They all want the spoils. They want to be in charge. They want to live in the palace. They want to be driven around in limousines at public expense. You know, they want the expense accounts. They can go anywhere they want, charge anything they want, and the people will pay for it through taxes. That's what they really want. They want that power and that prestige, and they vie with each other for it. And they use these slogans just to trick the people into supporting them. And they don't have any interest in the people whatsoever except to fool them.
So this equality that you're talking about, it's all... Because at the end of it, at the end of the day, these administrators of this kind of system benefits from that, and they can live the good life on their own, right? I mean, you look at
exactly that's what it is.
Look at Russia. I mean, take that as an example. It was a breadbasket at the time before the revolution. Things turned to crap pretty quick. Mass murder. It was the gulags and everything else. I mean, and still to this day. It's almost like it's not really focused on that much. It is still kind of hushed up and not really accepted. We always hear about the other mass murders or the Holocaust and everything else, but in that one in Russia, it's kind of still the lid is on that one for some reason.
Yeah, right. Well, because Mother Russia is the role model of such a large segment of the world population. You know, it was the birthplace of communism. And that's one of the major forms of collectivism. And there are a lot of people who think of themselves as communists, or at least as Leninists, and that's really the heart of it. And so they don't want that tarnished image of Mother Russia. So they ignore it, and gradually it goes away, and young people are born into the system and never hear about it. And so when you talk about it, they think, oh, you're nuts. I never heard about that. It can't be true.
Yeah, I know. You did an excellent interview with a former KGB agent, Yuri Bezmenov. That was like, 1984 or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, Yuri. Boy, what an eye-opener that was.
Oh, yeah.
The guy that he was born into the highest strata in the communist system. His father was a general in the army. He had the good life. He was recruited into the KGB. Yeah, he was one of the people I'm talking about. He had everything, free, and prestige, protection, lots of money, and he finally got sick of the system. He could see the hypocrisy of it and the suffering, and he, at great risk to his own life, he escaped, and that was a time when you tried to break away from the KGB, it would usually cost you your life. Because they track you down, and they did track him down, and they tried to kill him a couple of times, and then finally, I guess they got tired of that, and they went on to bigger fish to fry. But Yuri Bezmenov gave one heck of a testimony about the reality versus the image of what was going on inside Russia.
Yeah, wasn't it Lenin who called them the useful, idiots as well, that they went along?
Yes, I think that might have been Stalin.
Maybe,
the useful idiots, the idealistic ones that promote communism or socialism, or in Germany they promoted fascism and Nazism, but they were all useful idiots because they really believed in all of this and they helped overthrow the existing order. And then, as Yuri Bezmenov explained to us, once the new regime came to power, the first thing they did was to get rid of all those useful idiots that helped them to power. They round them up and shot them.
Yeah.
Because they knew that once they discovered that they'd made a huge mistake, they would be in the vanguard of opposition to the new regime as well.
They knew how the game was run, and therefore they were the first one to go because they realized...
The first ones to go, yeah.
Wow. Well, we had in 2006 Vladimir Bukovsky as well, a former Soviet dissident. He talks about fears that the European Union is on his way to becoming another Soviet Union. And looking around, I certainly don't doubt that, actually. How real is this danger in America, do you think, right now?
You mean as far as the European Union?
Well, the similarities, I guess, with the system, where things were heading. Can we make a comparison? Let's say how things were pre-revolution in Russia and what's happening in America right now.
Oh, yes, I think there's a very strong parallel, and I like the observation that the European Union is rapidly developing into a Soviet. It's the same system. It's actually a structure of collectivism. It's a logical thing. If you were a collectivist and you didn't have the Soviet model to follow, you would invent it, because that's what you need. You need to break down society into units and subunits with very rigid control from the top down, and call it a Soviet if you wish, or call it some other grouping. It doesn't make any difference. I know here in the United States, the activity is going on right now to establish local people's, they call them people's units, people's representatives, right down at the community level. And the idea is to get everybody into this structure as tightly as possible, and to give it the aura of being springing from the will of the people, because the people cannot resist the people. They can get angry at the government, but if they think that the government really is the people, whether it is or not, if they think it is, then they're stupefied. They think, well, who am I going to get mad at? Myself? My neighbors? You know? Then that's the reason they do that. They go to great lengths to create this image of this collectivist system somehow representing the people, and that the people are the force behind it, when in reality the people have no control whatsoever. It's all from the top down. Anyway, yeah, there's a great parallel. That's your question, and it's happening all over the world, and I think it's in the European Union you can see it very clearly.
The idea here as well is that this is really internationalism. The communists always talked about a world socialist state, and it wasn't until this was in place that it would work, I guess, on an optimal level. But this is also then when we enter in the realm of globalism, or, if you will, a new world order. So how close are these? If we take the old ideology of internationalism coming from the communist socialist world, and into the new era of the what we hear about all the time in terms of the new world order, how similar are these, do you think?
Well, they're totally similar. Well, maybe not totally. 1% difference, and that's the concept of who will dominate it. The Nazis had the idea of global control, and it would have been a Nazi regime. The communists had one of global control. They called it internet. That's where the word internationalism first really became into play. They had the Communist International and so forth. And again, that was described as international socialism. Well, by the time Cecil Rhodes came along and created his organization, originally it was to be dominated by Great Britain, but that was soon abandoned, and they decided to make it internationalism. And so by the time that came along, they realized it was necessary to eliminate the old stigmas of Nazism or communism, and just call it internationalism, and create the image of this was an amalgam of all the nations of the world, and with no emphasis on ideology. However, the ideology was just as strong as ever, but now they were talking about nations coming together and brotherhood and solving health problems and feeding the hungry, and that became the propaganda focus. The ideology was seldom discussed, but when you look at it, the ideology was exactly the same as it was under the German Hitler Mussolini combine and under Russia's communism. But the parallels are exactly, they're so strong. And the only difference really is that 1% veneer on the top, which is what you see when you look. If you don't look beneath the surface, what you see is something quite different, but it's really quite the same underneath.
And the danger as well is that even if it sounds good at the moment, let's say, or even if we happen to agree with some of the policies, how they're being run, let's say that we advance forward towards internationalism or something like that, then this system could gradually be changed towards a more radical and an extreme system than we would think of it today. This could, again, gradualism, they do this very, very well. But at the same time, the danger here is eventually that means also that there would be no options. I mean, I'm not here going to tell how other people should live their lives or whatnot, but the fact is already it's beginning to homogenize, again, becoming very close politically around the world. And I kind of appreciated when there were more differences. So if there was an opportunity, at least people could choose to go somewhere else if they didn't like it. But that's disappearing now. That's what's so dangerous about this.
Well, that's the nature of collectivism. Under collectivism, some body of rulers will decide what is best in every area of life. They will decide what is best internationally. They will decide what is best nationally at the state, local level. They'll decide what is best for you to think, what is best for you to wear, what is best for you to take on as employment, what is best for you to eat. You know, everything. They'll make these decisions, and that's what, of course, is going on at the UN right now. There are a couple of billion pages literally produced by the UN every year, billion, I said, and all of those pages have to do with rules and regulations and guidelines for controlling people's lives and you know, even standards for garbage collection. And that's the nature of collectivism. Everybody will follow the rules, and if you step out of line, of course, then you have to be punished. That's the nature of collectivism, and it's like pregnancy. There's no a little bit of pregnancy. You're either pregnant or you're not, and once you're pregnant, you're going to go to full term. Once collectivism starts, it never stops until it goes to full term. Full term means 100% government and 0% personal freedom. And that's what we see in the world, going on everywhere. It's been going on now for a little over 100 years. The process has been moving. And now, as we speak, we're coming close to the end of that movement. If we don't turn this thing around pretty soon, we're going to wind up at 100% government, which means totalitarianism worldwide.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you as well, Ed, if you think we're going to be offered a third way, I guess. It's been called this way. It's a blend of corporatism and socialism or social democratic politics. I mean, we have that here in Sweden. I say it's actually the worst of two worlds or two systems. It's a corporate monopoly where most things are regulated by the government, of course, but everything is outsourced to private companies on top of that. And only one, usually as well, private company, by the way, so there's no room for competition or getting options into the picture there. But the fact is that this Nordic model or the Swedish model, as it's been called, is something that I see promoted around the world in many different settings by economists, politicians, and university professors. They praise the system. It comes up high ranking in UN's top places of the world kind of thing all the time. And these Nordic countries have more people in the public sector than most other countries around the world. And this is this third way, the blend in between. But I still see this as incredibly detrimental, as I've gone into, on other programs and with other people as well. But have you heard about this? And what do you think about this third way, basically, if that's incoming and taking the place of this?
Well, I understand what you're saying. I would question whether or not it really is a new way or a third way. It's really a kind of a reorganizing of things. The bottom line is that there's still an oligarchy, but instead of the oligarchy being completely centered in the government, it's shared with the corporate structure. But still, it's an oligarchy, and the corporations that are given the monopoly to do whatever it is that they're going to do. For example, here in the United States, the Federal Reserve System is a private corporation, and it's exactly the same as you're talking about. It's a private entity, but it's been given the power by the federal government to create the nation's money supply.
Right.
So there you have exactly the model I think you're talking about. What difference does it make whether it's a private company or whether it's government? It's still, you have to do it or you go to prison. It's still, you have no voice in it. It's not responsive to the electorate. It's legalized plunder. So it's just a new way of doing what they've been doing for a long time. And I don't think that in essence it makes an awful lot of difference.
I agree, completely agree. This is what I'm seeing happening in this country and many others around the world as well, and that that system is being promoted. And I always kind of try to raise a red flag for those people who are in some way living in an illusion that these systems up here are in any way any better. And some people even visit believe so still to this day, and I do the best I can to try to warn them about that. And I think that this is how they constantly do it. They change the words or the definitions of it, or some slight little, you know, they're rearranging a little bit the furniture, but it's actually, it's still the same main building, still the same house, and we're talking about the same entity, basically, because as you said, Ed, if the philosophy is the same, then there really isn't any difference.
Well, yes, and you can see that in Russia today. When we read about the supposed fall of communism, everybody was so happy. But I looked at that thing, and I talked to my Russian friends, and they said, big trick, big trick. And communism didn't fall. They just, all that they did is they changed their name. The commissars that used to be in control, they took their hats off. And then in front of the hat they used to wear, it said commissar. And they turned the hat around, and now the front said social democrat. But it was, the hat was on the same head. The same people were in charge. They were doing exactly the same thing, except now they were using different words, as you say. And they didn't call it communism anymore. They called it social democracy. But exactly the same thing happened. And the big commissars that were in charge of the former system now were running some of the industries, supposedly as independent, competitive, well, they call themselves even capitalists once in a while, but there was no capitalism there. It was all monopoly, and they were given monopolistic power over their particular segment of the industry, and it was just like the mafia, really. And it was just the same people were doing the same thing, but they were describing it in a different way, and that's what we have to be aware of all around the world.
If people have had ever seen what you call true capitalism in the, you know, once in their life, since you said before this has been gone for a long time now, but if they would get a chance to see this, do you think that they would favor it as opposed to over any of the other systems that we've tried so far?
Oh, I think they would, because they could see the results. If they were able to work within it, they would feel the results as well. But you know, most people now are afraid of freedom. They give lip service to freedom, but they're afraid of it. The typical reaction is that, well, it's good to be free, and I'm all for that. But, you know, there are certain areas that freedom won't work, like health care. You can't allow freedom of choice there because some people will not get health care. And you can't have freedom in the schools because, you know, some people might not get a good education or the right education. You can't have freedom in the banking industry because, you know, the banks may cheat people out of money. And you can't have freedom here and you can't have freedom there. Everything that's important.
Yeah.
They say, well, everything. If it's important, they'll say, well, freedom won't work there. I think the only freedom they really believe in is the freedom to choose the color of your socks.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's true. It's all full of different versions of, you know, the shampoo or whatever in the aisles there. But I think what they're afraid of is responsibility. Correct?
Yes. Yeah. They're afraid they're afraid of responsibility. They're afraid of failure. And, of course, everybody's afraid of failure, but you have to assume the risk of failure if you want the opportunity to succeed. The two go together.
Because what has ended up happening is that the infrastructure for people to be able to get themselves out of a situation is more or less gone. I know it's non-existent in the country I'm in, Sweden, pretty much. It's not there, so there's no really... There's no big incentive, if I can put it that way, no matter how hard you try. Let's say if you're in a position of you know, working as a, you know, service of some kind, then so it doesn't really matter. The quality is across the board, and it doesn't really matter if you try harder or not. You're protected, I think, over the top sometimes by the unions who put those who actually are, you know, employing people in a really, really bad situation. Look at what happened over in the States with your your Twinkies company, Hostess, right? The union
right.
Refused to budge So what happened is that instead of them going down a little bit in wages, which is very unfortunate, but they had to do something because of their situation. All the 18,000 people now lost their jobs. Is that fair? Is that good? You know?
Yeah. And so they're now on welfare. And so they didn't lose their income. Maybe they had took a reduction in income anyway, but they still had their jobs. And so that means that all the rest who are still working are paying out of their wages for those who are not working anymore. And that process just keeps going on and on until finally everybody's on welfare and nobody's working anymore, and that's the end of the line. The system is through.
And the welfare state eventually collapsed. I'm referencing Sweden here, but back in the 90s that happened, and we haven't recovered since, and we're more in debt now than ever before. So good stuff.
Well, that's why I say the creature of collectivism always grows. It just goes in one direction until finally it's total. There may be spurts and there may be lags in the rate in which it moves, but it always moves. And the end of that line is totalitarianism, because when everybody's out of work, then you have to have bread lines and you have to have the government come in and provide the food and the clothing and the shelter and the healthcare and everything. And when the government provides everything for a person, that person really is a slave to the government. They cannot resist.
And on top of that, the problem is that you don't have any options in the services provided by the government. So that means you don't have any internal competition, and they don't have any reason to try any harder or try to improve what they're doing. That's why things usually also go down the drain when it's a monopoly-owned thing, you know?
Right, yeah, there's no incentive to provide service. And the providing of the service at that point just becomes kind of an excuse for the privilege that the people have to run the system. They don't really care about providing the service, but that's their excuse for having the paycheck and being in that little favored position, so they give it lip service. But when it comes to delivering the service, it's pretty poor.
That's right. Well, there is a lot of problems in the world, and many different systems have been tried, and yet we're getting a revamp and a kind of version of the same old stuff. And I think it's time to begin to think about something new, or heading in a new direction, of course. But I wanted to ask you about something else here as well. I'm sure you've heard or read about the talk of secession of the states that are currently united today. Do you see this as a good option? Have you heard about this?
You mean here in the United States?
That's right. Yep.
Oh, yes. Well, there's some talk about that. I personally don't give it an awful lot of credence. First of all, that issue was tested during the Civil War quite a while ago. Some of the states in the South wanted to secede from the Union, which, by the way, they're certainly entitled to do. They created the Union. The Union was merely like a treaty between various countries. That's all it was. That's what the United States started out to be, is a treaty between the 13 countries, or the colonies, and they created this treaty and a constitution which defined the terms of their cooperation, and it was primarily just for mutual defense against foreign invaders and to run a post office, and that was about it. But, of course, mission creep crept into it. And by the time of the Civil War, when some of the nations or states, as they really were called, decided they were not getting a fair shake out of the deal, and they said, oh, we quit, then the North invaded the South, said, no, you can't quit. We'll come down and kill you if you try that. And that's the war decided that they couldn't secede. So now we have today people talking about seceding, but the states are not talking about it, but just people are talking about it. Well, if the state can't do it with its military power, what's an individual going to do about it? If I decided I'm going to secede from the Union, how do I go about doing that? I can say, okay, I seceded. I'm going to tear up my Social Security card now. I don't want my retirement benefits anymore. And I'm not going to use my Social Security number. I'm a true sovereign citizen, and I'm not going to pay my taxes. So what happens? They come and put me in jail. So I seceded, and I'm in their jail. I just don't understand this. It seems so shallow. I don't think people understand what they're dealing with.
Hmm. Otherwise, beyond these things, what do you, I guess, recommend for the individual to do to, maybe in a to a certain extent then disconnect themselves from this system and to become more, I guess, independent. Certainly information and learning about what we're part of is always a good thing, and learning more about those kinds of systems and modalities, and of course help to spread the message about those things to other people so they too can make the right choice of how they want to live their lives. But beyond those things, Ed, what do you recommend for individuals in such a collectivist state that the whole world is in at this point?
Well, in my view, I think there's only one solution. Only one. You cannot, well, maybe you can maneuver a little bit within the system. You can, you know, try and survive. You can try and not to be noticed, you know, not to make waves, which is what a lot of people try to do. They think if they're not noticed and if they don't make waves, somehow, you know, everything will be fine. What they don't realize is the system will continue to grow, and they're going to be devoured anyway. Maybe not quite as fast, but eventually they and their children and their grandchildren are still going to be devoured by the system. So that's not my approach. I want true reform. And I believe that the only way to bring about a change in this system is to become active in the system, to move into the system, to seek influence, to seek leadership, to spread the word, to try and actually recapture the system, not to get along with it, not to escape it, but to recapture it and to change it. Now, that's a hard thing to do, and it even is kind of dangerous. A guy could get hurt doing that kind of thing. But it's, in my view, the only way. And so the reason we created an organization called Freedom Force International is because we are trying to create a network of people all around the world with that vision. And so our total focus is how to recapture control of the systems and change it, not to get along with it, but actually change it. So anybody that's interested in participating in that mission, I urge them to come onto the internet and look us up and see what it's all about. It's called freedomforceinternational.org.
All right, very good. freedomforceinternational.org. Also, before we wrap things up here then for this time, tell us about your other website and some of the things that you have on there for people who want to learn more about your work, Ed.
Yes, well, Freedom Force, of course, is our, I like to think of it as a think tank. It's where we deal with ideas and strategies and tactics and that kind of thing. We have nothing to sell there except ideas and concepts. But our commercial site is called realityzone.com. And there we have about 100 different items for sale, books, video recordings, audio recordings, and things like that on various aspects of the problem we're facing and on the solution. So if you want to really get into the educational materials, you'll find them at realityzone.com.
Absolutely. And of course, your classic, The Creature from Jekyll Island, I think it's in its fifth edition right now?
It's its fifth edition, and as a matter of fact, last night I just sent off the revised pages for the 34th printing.
Ah, wow. So, there we go. Yeah. Great stuff. Now, that we recommend, of course, for everyone who wants to learn more about the Federal Reserve and the background on that. And then I saw you have a couple of new DVDs out, I guess. The Great Culling, is that a new one from you?
Well, we're distributing it. It was not produced by us, but we certainly liked it a lot and offered to distribute it. And the producers said, sure, let's go. The Great Culling, it's a very important documentary on what appears to be, and I don't see anybody can challenge it, what appears to be a deliberate exposure of the world population to chemicals in the food supply, in the water, and in the air, and in the medicines. Chemicals that have only one really provable purpose, and that is to shorten longevity and reduce reproductive capacity. In other words, there's a program underway to reduce the population drastically, like about 90%, 97% of the population. I got that backwards. I think it's 87 reduction. Anyway, it's a huge amount. These people are determined to eliminate or cull a huge percentage of the world population, and they're doing it not by lining them up against walls and shooting them with bullets, but poisoning them and causing them to die sooner and to be less productive, reproductive.
All right. People can check that out, of course. And a while back, you were involved in why in the world are they spraying that's available on realityzone.com as well. Do you have any new projects upcoming, Ed, or are you promoting and doing things as usual right now?
Well, nothing big like that at the moment. I'm still working on my my next book. I've been working on it for so long, I'm embarrassed to even talk about it. But I do work on it almost a little bit every week, and maybe within the next year we can announce that. But in the meantime, nothing new that we're ready to crow about.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, anyway,
we got plenty else to crow about. If anybody wants to just come to our website, there are 100 really great items there to choose from.
Indeed, lots of good stuff there. Realityzone.com once more. Then. All right. Well, we'll wrap things up for this time. Thank you again for coming on the program, Ed, sharing your perspective with us and talking more with us about these troubling issues. So we appreciate the perspective. Thanks.
Well, Henrik, thank you so much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you for listening. We'll proceed with more in just a few days with a roundtable on 2012. This is with Jay Widener, Barbara Hanclo, and Lawrence Joseph as we come closer to the 21st of December and then finally can move on from this subject. But it's a very interesting program with some very interesting ideas presented, and you shouldn't miss it. So I'll hope you listen in then. In the meantime, check out redicecreations.com for more. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a good, productive day wherever you are. Take care.